Case number 21-5117. St. Helena Clear Lake Hospital, doing business as Adventist Health Clear Lake, appellant versus Xavier Becerra, Secretary, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Ms. Carroll for the appellant, Ms. Edwards for the appellee.
Good morning. This is Judge Wilkins. Ms. Carroll, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Kelly Carroll on behalf of appellant St. Helena Clear Lake Hospital. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. The question presented is whether the secretary lawfully disallowed Medicare payment for the on-call costs that the hospital incurred to assure that specialist physicians are available to treat the hospital's Medicare inpatients. The answer is no for two basic reasons. First, the secretary based the disallowance on a regulation that did not apply, while the secretary ignored the regulation that does apply. Second, the applicable regulation requires the secretary to pay the hospital's necessary and proper costs, and the undisputed factual record shows that the only way the hospital can have the specialty physicians necessary to serve its inpatients is by paying doctors for being on call during set hours. This is because of the lack of available specialists in the rural and mountainous area where the hospital is located. Thus, we ask this court to set aside the decision of the PRRB, find that these inpatient on-call costs must be reimbursed, and remand to the secretary for calculation of the Medicare payments that are due. I welcome your questions, Your Honors, or I would be happy to provide additional detail on our arguments.
Can you just start out by explaining if we disagree with you on the issue of whether either the California statute of regulation or the federal EMLAT, or I'm probably got the acronym wrong, that neither of those required the on-call physicians, we would sustain the secretary's decision and wouldn't need to reach anything else, correct?
Your Honor, in this case, the secretary is required to conduct an analysis of whether the costs are necessary and proper. And the PRRB, standing in the shoes of the secretary here, did not so conduct that analysis. So to answer your question more directly, even if you were to find that those specific laws did not so require, the secretary would still need to conduct an analysis of whether these on-call costs were necessary and proper. But here, of course, those laws do require that the hospital incur these costs to serve its inpatients.
I'm a little confused. Did you abandon the notion that the California law requires the payment for on-call physicians in your opening statement?
No, Your Honor. We absolutely did not, and forgive me if I implied that. We did not abandon that the California state law so requires. In fact,
can you show us where you found the requirement?
Yes, Your Honor. So it is the unique purview of states to license facilities and to license the practitioners and set forth standards of care for those practitioners in hospital facilities. And the controlling Medicare regulations, as I noted, require critical access hospitals and their staff to be in compliance with federal, state, and local laws and regulations. Those are the Medicare conditions of participation.
Perhaps you'd point to the state statute, which you say requires on-call physicians for inpatient?
Your Honor, for example, in California licensing laws require hospitals to provide 24-hour inpatient care, including surgical and other physician-provided services. There's Section 7, California Code of Regulations, Title 22, Section 70005.
What language are you referring to?
If I may get my binder.
Okay.
70001 states that essential services required by law for licensure as a hospital must include surgical services. 70005A
requires. Stop, but 70011 does say services, surgical services, but that doesn't require on-call surgeons.
That is correct, Your Honor. But the issue.
And elsewhere, it indicates that emergency room doctors with surgical training are perfectly adequate, right?
Well, Your Honor, emergency room physicians, there's nothing in the record to state that emergency room physicians would be available to move over to the inpatient area of the hospital to service inpatients with surgical service needs. There's nothing in the record to suggest that. And in fact, the undisputed record.
Wasn't it your burden to show that there were none available? You only have a stipulation, but the secretary is not bound by the stipulation.
But Your Honor, the secretary's own agent agreed to the stipulation, and that's all that is in the record here.
It's a contractor, and a contractor is not, previous cases have indicated the secretary is not bound by the contractor's stipulation. So it's your burden to show that there were no doctors available. That emergency room doctors wouldn't be trained. You know, unfortunately for you, I've actually been in one of these hospitals and had emergency room doctors do surgical work.
I understand, Your Honor. But in this case, the hospital is entitled to, once the hospital holds itself out in the state of California as offering, for example, a basic service such as surgery or a supplemental service such as pediatrics, perinatal care, or cardiology, the state, which happened here, the hospital must maintain continuous compliance with the supplemental service requirements. We do concede that the word on-call is not in this regulation, but what we've shown here is that the only possible way for the hospital to adequately meet the requirements of state law, which is continuous compliance, is by having the services of contracted on-call specialty physicians.
Well, not true. The emergency room doctors are trained generally on providing a little bit of service for everything.
Your Honor, each of those services requires that in that department, the hospital is obligated to have a physician responsible for the particular service.
So your view is California requires on-call physicians in every one of these specialties?
Your Honor, in this case, what we're saying is that California law requires these specialty physicians to be available. And as the undisputed record in this case
that's not true. Or anybody trained in services. You don't have to be an obstetrician to be trained on certain emergency situations.
Even in the perinatal example, that the hospital must have somebody trained in that specialty overseeing someone who may just have some training in that specialty.
Where do you see that?
So in 70549 is the regulation governing perinatal unit staff. And it says a physician shall have overall responsibility of the unit. So that unit is not the outpatient emergency department, which is a completely separate area of the hospital paid under a different cost center. The physician shall be certified or eligible for certification by the American Board of Obstetrics or Gynecologists or the American Board of Pediatrics.
If such a pediatrician is not available, a physician with training and experience in pediatrics may administer the service.
Yes, but a physician with the above qualifications, meaning the qualifications of the American Board of Obstetrics and Gynecologists or the American Board of Pediatrics, shall provide consultation at a frequency which will assure high quality service. And that that individual shall be responsible for providing continuous obstetric, pediatric, anesthesia, laboratory, and radiologic coverage.
So the emergency room doctors have to be periodically trained.
Your Honor, the emergency room doctors would not be available to have overall responsibility for a unit of the inpatient side of the hospital. They have to be available 24/7 to service the emergency room physicians. But Your Honor, the issue here is
Let me ask another question.
Yes, Your Honor.
What about the government's position that even if you were right on the second question, which I doubt, but even if you were right, the government has ability to determine whether it's necessary and proper before you ever get to that issue. And that's, don't we have to defer to the secretary on this?
Yes, Your Honor, we agree that the secretary is charged under the regulation with determining whether the costs were necessary and proper. Our argument here, the central focus of our argument here, is that the decision of the PRRB did not opine on whether the costs at issue were necessary and proper under the correct and applicable regulation at 413.9. Instead, the sole reason the board gave was that as a matter of law, 42 CFR 413.70B4, a regulation found only under the outpatient setting, a regulation that explicitly provides for Medicare reimbursement for critical access hospitals for on-call costs in the outpatient emergency room setting only, the board said that would clearly exclude the on-call services performed in the inpatient areas of the hospital. And the board said in conclusion, yes, Your Honor.
You're asking just for a remand for the board to make that determination, or are you more aggressively also asking that we reverse outright on that point, on the necessary and proper point?
Your Honor, we believe that the record here that it's been stipulated to by the parties demonstrates that these costs were necessary and proper. So we are asking the court here to remand and order that these inpatient costs must be reimbursed, but remand to the secretary for the calculation of those Medicare payments that are due.
Can I ask you maybe a really basic question, but does an emergency room physician have to be a surgeon?
No, Your Honor. I anticipate, Your Honor, that like most medical students, and my apologies, this is not in the record, but my understanding is that medical students do rotations in surgery.
No, but emergency room doctors have surgical training. I've been treated by an emergency room doctor with surgical in a surgical situation.
Yes, Your Honor, I'm concurring with your statement. They do receive surgical training, Your Honor.
Well, isn't that all that's necessary?
No, here, Your Honor, because under California law and under federal law, which requires following state laws on things like licensure and including facility licensure and physician licensure, the inpatient departments, including surgery, which is a basic service in California for general acute care hospitals like this hospital, that department must have coverage by a surgeon. There is nothing in the record to show that an emergency room physician could be moved over to the inpatient side to care for patients and then abdicate their duties on the ER side. Yes, Your Honor.
Coverage by a surgeon or coverage by, a very counterintuitive concept to me, but a doctor who is not a surgeon, but close enough in order to do some surgeries.
Your Honor, I want to speak very precisely to this.
Okay.
I believe it's in the addendum on 44. Okay.
I mean, because I find your position as to surgery pretty appealing, except if there is some norm that untrained surgeons in some circumstances can do surgery, and that is in fact what happens in the ER, then it does seem like one possibility would be you have those docs do the double duty, and they do the surgeries in the ER and they do the surgeries, the inpatient surgeries.
Your Honor, I want to return first to your question about what's in the state law. So for the surgical service staff, this is at addendum 46, section 70225. A physician shall have overall responsibility for the surgical service. This physician shall be certified or eligible for certification in surgery by the American Board of Surgery. It does say if such a surgeon is not available, a physician with additional training and expert experience in surgery shall be responsible for the service. But one or more surgical teams, this is at B, of consisting of physicians, registered nurses, and other personnel shall be available at all times. It just strains practicality, and it strains the sort of very nature of a hospital where, as you may well be familiar of the Two Midnights case, the Shands case, you know, we've spent, this court has experienced years of litigation on what it means to be admitted as an inpatient. It is, you know, unique in the statutory language. It's unique in the regulatory language at issue here. It's paid under a separate payment program with a separate calendar of yearly calendar of federal regulations here. So I can't stress enough how different the outpatient side, which includes the emergency department, is from the inpatient side in the Medicare program. And here it's saying under California law that a surgical team that includes a physician shall be available at all times for the surgical service, which is on the inpatient side.
Or someone trained.
Yes, Your Honor.
Where do you find the requirement in California law that a surgeon be available on the inpatient side? Tell me where you find that.
Well, in this section here.
Where? Show me where. Just read the line.
Sorry.
In A or B?
So A is discussing the physician's qualifications responsibility, but B is explaining.
So let's just start with A and then go to B, and hopefully, because you might have two different theories here, which I'm trying to unpack. A says gold standard is the board certified surgeon. And if you can't get that, you can be in compliance with the rule by having the next best thing, which is a physician with additional training and experience in surgery. I read that as meaning you have to have a surgeon. He might be just out of medical school and not yet ready for board surgery, but still a surgeon. Am I overreading that?
I don't believe you are, Your Honor. And the other thing I would stress is that I think that this provision is also saying that it shall have overall responsibility and be responsible for this service. So this is surgical service staff. That's what this section is pertaining to.
So the language I just read to you might or might not support you for the reasons we've been discussing, but then I thought you were quoting us a different provision, maybe in B, about a surgeon or surgeon-like doctor with the supervisory responsibility. So walk me through that.
Well, I had previously was discussing the perinatal unit staff where—
let's talk about surgery.
Okay, yes. So on surgery, what I was discussing is that the provision at B explains that surgical team, which also does include nurses and other medical personnel, must be available at all times. Surgery in the state of California is a basic service. When the hospital's been around for 70 years. It's had its critical access hospital. Yep.
Who has to be on that team besides, at a minimum, the physician with additional training and experience in surgery?
Your Honor, the regulation here states that it must consist of physicians, registered nurses, and other personnel shall be available at all times.
So that doesn't really push the ball any further than the debate we've been having about A.
No, Your Honor, but what it does, in terms of the physician qualifications, I agree that it does not speak more specifically about the physician qualifications, but what it does say is that the physician must be available at all times for the surgical service. And that is the surgical service on the inpatient side of the hospital. So it is impossible to have continuous inpatient surgical coverage and then say that those physicians could be
positioned in this. Where does it say inpatient in 70225?
Your Honor, I you're correct that I don't see the word inpatient, but this is a separate section of the regulations that it's separate from emergency department coverage. And it also is a separate, when a hospital is licensed, it's licensed for things like surgery, which are in a separate piece of being licensed for having an emergency department. And this hospital, as a general acute care hospital in California, which it had that license well before it became a critical access hospital in 2005, one of the basic services is surgery.
Why would it not work for the ER docs to be available for the inpatient? I mean, let's assume we agree with you that the inpatient surgical department is an administratively and legally separate part of the hospital from the outpatient or non-inpatient ER, and they're still on the same campus. The physician who is physically present at one of those will be within whatever, a 5-minute walk of the other. So why isn't that a plausible option for the hospital to satisfy state law? And yeah, you know, it may be that if the physician is doing an operation in the ER, he's unavailable to do an operation in the inpatient section of the building, but that's no different from the doctor is doing a surgery on one emergency and for that time unavailable for the next person who walks into the ER.
Your Honor, it's not part of the record, the issue of whether there were ER physicians available to service inpatients, but the undisputed issue in this record is that in order to service inpatients, which is necessary under both federal and state law, the undisputed record said that the only way this hospital could practically service the needs of its inpatients was to have on-call physicians. I understand.
Actually, the problem is only to stabilize under the federal law, right? To stabilize patients who come in through the emergency room, make sure they're stabilized, because this hospital is not supposed to keep people more than 96 hours on the average. And so if there's serious surgical complications, they would have to be transferred to a bigger hospital. So and emergency room doctors are trained in stabilization.
Your Honor, so to your point, I think you're discussing here the EMTALA, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. And the issue there is that the hospital must either, it does not require, first of all, the EMTALA does not require hospitals to transfer a patient once the patient is stabilized. And
it's not required, right. It could be anticipated.
Your Honor, absolutely. EMTALA does anticipate that if the hospital is unable to stabilize a patient, that it could transfer a patient. But here, Your Honor, there are a couple things in the record that speak to the fact that this hospital should be servicing inpatients. One is that the secretary's own regulations state that the critical access hospital program was established to improve access for rural residents to essential healthcare services and particularly hospital services. Hospital and services include acute care inpatient services. And when critical access hospitals do not provide them, this is the language of the secretary, the individuals residing in that rural community may be at risk. We believe it is not in the best interest of a critical access hospital's beneficiaries to be routinely transferred to a more distant hospital if instead their care could be provided locally without compromising quality. And here I might add that the closest tertiary hospital, meaning a hospital with more advanced care, is over an hour away. And this is over mountainous terrain, two-lane roads that sometimes get closed down by mudslides.
And there are helicopters available in emergency situations.
Well, my client has said to me, yeah, I understand, Your Honor, but they have explained to me that a helicopter is not always available. So, Your Honor, I don't think it is fair for a hospital that is required to furnish inpatients under the Medicare conditions of participation to then say, we are trying to prevent you from servicing those inpatients. The secretary stipulated, the PRRB adopted the stipulations that stated the only practical way that this hospital could service its inpatients
was to have a contract. What about your contract? Don't you have a contract for more services than you're claiming you're required to provide? What is your contract?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Do you mean
Don't you have a contract with a medical organization to provide doctors?
Your Honor, the hospital has contracted with various on-call physicians, yes.
No. You have a contract to provide doctors in emergency room, don't you?
The hospital also has contracts to provide emergency room physicians. That's not part of the joint appendix here, but those are separate contracts to provide emergency room physicians.
Well, and they're pretty extensive. It seems to me I saw that in the briefs. Isn't that correct? What do you provide? What is your contract? You have contracted with an organization to provide doctors, right?
We have contracted with different. We've contracted with an organization, my understanding is to provide emergency room physicians, but that's not the costs that are at issue here. We have contracted also and provided an example contract of one of these on-call specialty physicians. We've contracted directly with physicians to provide specialty on-call services.
Yeah, and you had to actually have them on staff, don't you?
Yes, Your Honor.
So why do you need on call if you have on staff?
Oh, I think we're using different terminology. So what I'm saying is that the hospital could not staff it. So, Your Honor, physicians are only paid, and this is not at issue in this case. I want to be very clear. The costs that the hospital has requested and sought reimbursement for here are not for the professional services rendered by these on-call physicians. That is paid under a different payment regime, and the physicians would independently bill for any services that they provide. What these costs are for is to have a physician who's not working elsewhere at the time that they are on call, be on call and called in and be able to arrive at the hospital in a certain amount of time to service inpatients as needed, arises.
How many doctors do you have on staff?
Your Honor, I do not know the answer to that question.
How can you not know the answer if you're arguing the case? I don't understand that.
Well, Your Honor, I it's not part of the record of this case. I could certainly follow up with a supplemental letter, but
who has the burden to show that the circumstances?
Your Honor, we believe that the record has shown here, and certainly the secretary has the burden to analyze whether the costs are necessary and proper. We have provided documentation Medi-Cal has also analyzed these costs and determined them to be necessary and proper. And the reason that is meaningful is because the Medi-Cal program, the Medicaid agency in California, is both familiar with state law and, in this case, applies federal regulatory provisions. It applied 413.9, analyzed the costs here, and found that these costs were necessary and proper for this hospital to incur.
But isn't the question whether they're necessary and proper a question for the secretary in the first instance?
Yes, the secretary is, it's the secretary's burden to analyze.
If the secretary concludes they aren't necessary and proper, then we don't even have to get into whether California requires it, right?
Yes, Your Honor. If the secretary were to analyze, that's all we're asking for here, is that the secretary should have analyzed whether these costs were necessary and proper. Well, we've offered arguments as to why they are, including that the hospital is required to incur these costs under state laws in order to service its inpatients. There are Medicare conditions of participation that also require furnishing services to inpatients in a critical access hospital.
No, but the government is arguing you don't even get into the question of whether California requires, which they don't think California does require, but we don't even get into that question if the government, if the secretary concludes it's not necessary or proper.
Your Honor, all we have asked for here is that the secretary do the analysis of whether the costs were necessary and proper. The factual record below in the PRRB shows that the PRRB did not analyze whether these costs were necessary and proper. And in fact, the PRRB decision below had two issues in it. One was this issue of on-call costs. Another was whether outpatient meals to patients were payable. In the section on on-call costs, the board never referred to or discussed section 413.9, whether the costs were reasonable, necessary, and proper. It did not discuss any of that. The PRB's analysis relied solely on the inapplicable, facially inapplicable regulation at 413.70b4, and the PRRB found these costs unallowable under that regulation by negative implication. The PRRB decision, in the same decision, on the next page, the PRRB's analysis discusses and rests its analysis entirely under 413.9. So the PRRB was well aware of 413.9, used it to decide whether the outpatient meals were allowable. They found actually that those meals were allowable, reversing the Medicare contractor. And they quoted the language of 413.9. So we think it is undisputed that the board applied the wrong regulation in this case. So there's nothing, the adjudication was on the wrong grounds. And that's what we're saying here. So yes, Your Honor, I agree with you that it is the secretary's burden to analyze whether these costs are necessary and proper under 413.9.
I didn't say it was the secretary's burden.
Oh, excuse me, Your Honor, that the secretary should analyze these costs as to whether they are necessary and proper.
Didn't the secretary or the PRRB say it doesn't matter whether California law effectively requires on-call coverage?
Yes. The board said that even if the board could confirm state licensing and certification rules requiring these specialty physicians, state laws that, quote, conflict with clear federal Medicare payment regulations would not change the outcome of this appeal.
Okay, then there's really nothing for us to remand. They've already said that they don't think payment is necessary and proper, even if there's a state law obligation to have on-call services. And we review that and we either uphold it or we reverse it.
Respectfully,
we already have an explanation.
Your Honor, in that section, the clear federal regulation that the board is referring to is 413.70B4, which is found only in the outpatient section of the critical access hospital payment regulations. It's also found only in the outpatient statute pertaining.
You're arguing against the negative implication, aren't you?
Yes, yes, Your Honor, we are arguing against the negative implication here because there is an explicitly applicable regulation on point, which the secretary did not apply in this adjudication. In addition, the negative implication here was not promulgated through notice and comment rulemaking.
Oh, but wait a minute, wasn't it in the preamble? Why is that not promulgated?
Your Honor, that statement in the preamble of I think you're referring to the 1998 final rule that established when critical access hospitals were established. It was in the context of discussing outpatient costs and emergency department, specifically emergency department costs. It was not promulgated in a proposed rule, so there was no notice. And then there was a comment from a commenter about the use of locum tenens, which are substitute emergency department physicians. And CMS stated the cost, the standby costs of emergency room physicians who are present in the, at the emergency room are allowable costs and be taken into account in computing Medicare payment. However, Medicare does not recognize costs of on-call physicians as allowable costs of operating a critical access hospital. However, that single sentence was in relation to the comment on the use of locum tenens physicians in emergency departments. Moreover, in the later regulation that was the federal fiscal year 2002 final rule in 2001, after Congress in 2000, presumably having read this and also understanding that the emergency department regulations and statutes pertaining to critical access hospitals are very specific and particularly onerous for hospitals. It's 24-hour a day coverage in the emergency department. And so when pressed, and also following this statement in the this preamble statement, Congress came back and revised the outpatient, again, only the outpatient side of the critical access hospital statute, and said, we will, they said that the secretary shall reimburse the costs of on-call emergency department physicians. But that's because they were looking at a specific issue pertaining to emergency department physicians. And even there, the secretary summed up by saying that in that rule that the permit the reasonable costs of critical access hospital outpatient services to include the reasonable compensation related to emergency room on-call physicians. There's no notice there that it had anything to do with reimbursement for inpatient physicians. I see, Your Honors, that
Silverman, further questions?
Oh,
just quickly, one more if we're done with the surgery point. For the other services at issue, where do you get the proposition that state law requires you to have an OBGYN or cardiology unit, inpatient unit?
Yes, Your Honor. So for perinatal, pediatric, and cardiovascular services, once a hospital is approved by the state to provide that supplemental service, which is what happened here, the hospital under section 70307 must, quote, maintain continuous compliance with the supplemental service requirements. Those supplemental service requirements obligate a hospital to have a physician responsible for the particular service. I understand, Your Honors, as we talked with about in the perinatal section already, as an example, that there are some provisions in there. The language says that it may permit physicians with different kinds of training, but the main condition is that there must be a physician overseeing it. And in especially with respect for perinatal, it must be a physician with that additional training and certification must oversee.
I understand that. getting at a slightly different point, which is that the regulations, they seem a little bit different insofar as they affirmatively require rural hospitals like your client to have an inpatient surgery department. They do not affirmatively require these other inpatient departments, which would seem to make the on-call costs much less necessary.
But Your Honor, once a hospital holds itself out, and again, this hospital has been there for 70 years and it's had an obstetrics department for that time, and on its license, its hospital license, it's licensed to have these perinatal OB beds. And so once it has held itself out to the community, again, a community that doesn't have a hospital, you know, nearby, two-lane roads, mountainous terrain, then it must continuously provide that service. So our argument is that once, yes, Your Honor.
You know, I still don't understand why you keep saying the surgeon is required to be on call. It says if such a surgeon is not available, a physician with additional training and experience in surgery shall be responsible for the service. Now, why can't that a emergency room doctor, and I cannot imagine anything that an emergency room doctor would know more than surgery. Why isn't it sufficient if he or she has training?
Your Honor, the issue is that the emergency room physician cannot go leave the duties that it is required to cover in the emergency.
Every hospital I've seen with such a situation is seamless between the emergency room and the inpatient services, and surgery emergency room doctors will move right with a patient into the inpatient sections. I don't understand why you are dividing it as if it was all divided in two parts.
Your Honor, there's nothing in the record to suggest that an emergency room physician would be available to service the inpatient areas of the hospital.
No, to and I understand patients from to stabilize sufficient. That's all that's necessary to stabilize them.
That's what's necessary under EMTALA, but it's required that a critical access hospital under federal law, under the conditions of participation for a critical access hospital, must furnish inpatient services. And what we're saying is, in order to meet that federal law and state laws for these specific services, this hospital, based upon its location, the lack of available physicians, needs to do so through on-call coverage arrangements. That's the only practical way it can meet its legal obligations to provide these services.
I have no further questions.
How do you respond to the waiver argument on page 27 of the secretary's brief on this point?
Your Honor, the issue of whether we waived our right to argue payment for the on-call specialty services relating to perinatal cardiology and pediatrics?
Yes.
Your Honor, I disagree that we waived that argument. We discussed all of the services, but focused on surgery because of the language of it being a basic service, and it had, and of course we also provided the contract of a surgeon. So we focused on that as an example, but as we explained also in our reply brief, the supplemental services, we provided additional background on the supplemental services in our reply brief. And those supplemental services, once a hospital has elected or needs to service the community it serves, offers those services. It's, and again, as I said, it's on the hospital's license that it offers these services. Then it needs to provide continuous coverage for those services. So no, Your Honor, we do not concede that we've waived argument with respect to those specialty services.
All right, thank you. Any other questions, Judge Katsas, Judge Silberman?
Nothing for me.
One question. How many doctors do you have on staff?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I do not know the answer to that question, but I will certainly speak with the client and can send a letter to the court on that question. And just to clarify, are you saying doctors that are not servicing the hospital through on-call arrangements, but are servicing the hospital through different means? Is that what you're asking?
On staff.
Okay, these physicians are on staff. It's just that they are—
Oh, no, I'm talking about those who are permanently connected.
Well, I think the issue is that this hospital has difficulty providing these specialty services. Again, the way critical access hospitals are, as you pointed out, Your Honor—
all I'm asking is how many doctors are on staff?
Your Honor, I do not know the answer to that question, but I'd be happy to find out for you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, counsel. We'll give you some time on rebuttal. Let's hear from counsel for the secretary, Kyle Edwards.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, Kyle Edwards on behalf of HHS. Given that much of the discussion has focused on the surgical services requirement under California law, I think it'd be useful to start there. First, I want to point out, if you're looking at the surgical services staff language at 70225, section 70225, what it's talking about here is a physician who shall have overall responsibility for the surgical services. This is the person who is in charge of the surgical services in the hospital. It's not referring to the doctor that needs to provide, that's providing care directly to a patient. And as the, so that's one problem, I think, with the argument that there needs to be on-call physicians under this particular section. The second is, as the board pointed out, this provision specifically allows for a doctor that does not have these special credentials, but just has additional training in surgery to fill the role of that that physician who provides overall responsibility for the surgical services. So again, this is the person who's providing, who's sort of running the surgical unit, not the doctor that's providing sort of hands-on care necessarily at every given point. Another problem with the surgical services argument that—
Why does that matter?
Because the argument here is that there needs to be an on-call doctor who's able to come in based off of this California regulation. And what this regulation is actually referring to is the doctor, you know, the head of the surgical wing, for instance. This is not sort of about, this is not talking about the doctor that has to be providing care at any given time. So that's the overall responsibility for the surgical services language.
I guess I'm not sure why that matters. I mean, we're struggling, or I'm struggling, because you have a state law requirement that they have to have an inpatient surgery department, and you have stipulation that the only way they can staff up what they have to staff up is through on-call arrangements. And where does that leave them? I mean, it seems to me, whether you're talking about the supervisor or the doctor who does the surgery, you put those two points together and it seems like on-call costs, at least for surgery, are pretty necessary. With this possible exception of maybe the ER doc does double duty. And I have no idea how to assess that, because it's just, the record is not developed on that point one way or the other.
So I think one thing that might address this concern entirely is that the California Health and Safety Code actually says, as we say in our brief, that a rural general acute care hospital does not need to provide surgical services. So in addition to, you know, this particular provision 70225 not requiring on-call surgical services, there's actually a provision in California law that says that rural general acute care hospitals do not need to provide surgical services. And in response, in their reply brief, St. Helena doesn't take issue with that.
That's 12508.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
And but there's been no, I mean, that wasn't the ground of decision below, either by the board or Judge Nichols, right?
It's correct that they did not cite that particular provision. The board said generally that the provisions that the provider cited to didn't require an on-call.
The rationale below is that it does, even assuming there's a state law requirement, they don't have to, it's not reimbursable under Medicare because of the negative implications.
And the necessary and proper.
There are alternative grounds. So backing up, you know, even if, again, I don't think it's inappropriate for the court to consider that the California law actually doesn't require these hospitals to provide surgical services, given that that's the primary argument they're making here, and given that they don't rebut that in their reply brief. They just say, well, we do decide to provide surgical services. So California law, licensing law, just simply doesn't require them to provide surgical services. It doesn't require them to provide these supplemental services, which is, I think, why they focused in their opening brief on the surgical services.
I'm with you on the supplemental. I'm worried about the surgery.
Well, I think
because of the seeming requirement in, what is it? I guess 7005 and 70011.
So, you know, if you ignore 1250A in the health and safety code, and you're just looking at 70225, as the board explained, this just talks about sort of the ideal qualifications. It says that someone with additional training in surgery can fulfill that role. And as was discussed earlier during the argument, the record does reveal that St. Helena has emergency room physicians available 24/7. And the board found that if an inpatient had an emergency that required them to be stabilized, that those emergency room physicians would be able to handle that issue. And the contracts, if you look to the contracts with Janssen and Janssen, they actually say that those physicians need to be able to handle unexpected emergencies, any unexpected emergencies. So those contracts, as was
noted. So to rule for you on this point, do we have to effectively conclude that the stipulation is wrong, at least as applied to this question of surgical services?
There are multiple bases. So, you know, I think the board also said that even if this was required by California law, for instance, that wouldn't necessarily mean that Medicare would be paying for it. You know, there are all sorts of things a hospital might be required to do by state or federal law, and that doesn't mean Medicare is going to pay for every single one of those things. In terms of the stipulation, that stipulation does not bind the secretary, who is not a party before the board. That was a stipulation between the hospital.
Okay, fair enough. But what's St. Helena supposed to do? They have a burden of proof. They have to show, for necessary, at a minimum, they have to show there's no other way. Let's assume they have to show there's no other way they can staff up the hospital. And they get a stipulation that seems to cover that point. I mean, what more could they have done? Do they have to ignore an offer of stipulation and litigate out something that the person on the other side of the V is willing to concede at that point?
So, you know, at the very least, they need to be able to point to something in the record that would support that stipulation. And they haven't done that. They've never pointed in their briefs to anything.
But why? That's the point of the stipulation.
That yeah, you exactly.
Put anything in to support it because the other side agrees to it.
Well, so the stipulation arose later. So there's hundreds of pages in the record, obviously. The stipulation arose just before the board. So there was plenty of opportunity. And indeed, the position papers below include, I think, exhibits 1-50 from the provider, the sort of initial position papers. So there was opportunity to introduce this. And it's not a, you know, it's not
let's
a...
Let's assume, counsel, the stipulation remains. What is your position then?
Well, they are attempting to rely on the stipulation as if it
were... let's assume we accept the stipulation. Then what's your position?
The position is that Medicare is not required to cover everything that a hospital might decide it wants to provide. Medicare is responsible for covering the provision of services to Medicare beneficiaries, and it's interested in the efficient delivery of needed healthcare services. So I think taking a step back and considering the nature of the critical access hospital is really important. So if you look to the designation requirements for a critical access hospital, and you look to what Congress was intending in creating this, it was trying to prevent the closure of these rural hospitals to enable there to be 24/7 emergency service.
So I'm just asking for your legal position if the stipulation were to be accepted.
If the stipulation were to be accepted, it wouldn't change anything. Again, the board said...
Why?
The board said that, you know, even if, for instance, California law required them to do this and they thought they needed to have these physicians to staff their units, requirements of California law would not determine what Medicare...
Well, the stipulation, if I understand our argument, doesn't go to California law so much as the practicality of whether it's necessary and proper.
I mean, the stipulation says, because of the rural nature of the service, the provider must pay doctors for being on call during set hours, which is the only practical way the provider can adequately staff its hospital with the doctors necessary to serve patients. Again, that's not really a factual stipulation. That is a legal conclusion that these costs are necessary and proper. And our position is that they were not necessary and proper. The board found that based on the conclusions that it drew with respect to California licensing law and EMTALA. And that given...
If the stipulation is true, that it's the only way they can provide surgical services, what is then the government's position?
That they are not required to provide surgical services by federal law, and they are not required to provide surgical services by state law. And that the purpose of these critical access hospitals is to provide 24/7 emergency care services. They do require inpatient, they are required to offer inpatient services, but that can be provided by a nurse. So there doesn't even need to be a physician available at all times at these hospitals. They're very limited service, 25 acute care beds or less, 96 hours per patient, inpatient on average. It is simply not consonant with the nature of these critical access hospitals that they would need to have on-call surgeons in addition to the other on-call doctors. I'll also note, just as a practical matter, they're trying to get on-call coverage costs for perinatal and pediatric services. It's a little unclear how that relates to Medicare, which covers persons that are 60, for the most part, covers persons that are 65 and older. There are some exceptions to that for younger people with disabilities. But I think that what that gets to is that the hospital here is really trying to get Medicare to pay for services that are just not what are necessary and proper under in view of the nature of a critical access hospital.
So suppose we think the following, and I know you reject these premises. I'm just trying to think through the decision tree here. Okay, point one, California law does require this hospital to have an inpatient surgery department. Point two, we accept the stipulation and read it to say that the only way this hospital can staff up the emergent inpatient surgical services that they're required to provide is to have on-call arrangements. If you get to that point, then you have the overarching federal requirement is that the services be necessary and proper. You're right that not every legally required service under state law might be compensable, but if you have the general obligation to, or the general rule is reimburse if necessary and proper, and you can't point to any specific exclusion under federal law. We get that. Why might we then still think, oh, but this might not be necessary and proper?
So I think, you know, the board, again, I just want to note that we disagree with those premises, but taking them as true, the board did say that, you know, even if California licensing law required this result, so accepting the, I think, both of those premises, it still would not mean that Medicare would be required to cover those costs. There's still an independent determination of whether the costs are necessary and proper. And the board made that determination. In addition to rejecting sort of the California law argument, it rejected the EMTALA argument. It said that, you know, if you're thinking just about the practical situation of this hospital.
I'm not worried about EMTALA. I'm just positing a state law obligation to
right.
have a surgery department. And I think that's their best.
I see. I mean, the provider is not pointed to any, they repeatedly point to the rule that the general requirement that a hospital has to comply with state and federal law. They haven't pointed to anything saying that requirement means that Medicare is going to provide payment for complying with the requirement. So I think that they haven't sort of totally closed the circle on that argument. With what they've given so far.
Okay. I understand the position. Thanks.
I am happy to answer any remaining questions that the panel has.
Judge Katsas, Judge Silverman.
I'm all set.
No more, this council.
All right. Thank you, council. We will give counsel for the appellant. We'll give you 2 minutes in rebuttal.
May I ask a question right at the outset? How do you respond to your opposing counsel's comment that the stipulation is not really a stipulation of fact, but is really a question of mixed fact and law?
Your Honor.
Or even law.
Your Honor, the stipulations here are stipulations of fact. So it does not say necessary and proper. It does
no,
not
no,
say.
You said it says this is the only way we can do this. But that is not really the classic factual determination, is it? That goes into all kinds of legal questions.
Well, Your Honor, I think it is a factual determination because the hospital is not able. It would be extremely expensive to have physician.
Aha. Uh-huh. So it'd be expensive, more expensive. Well, that means
no,
it's
and,
not,
and they aren't
that's
available.
Not impossible then.
No. I'm sorry, Your Honor. What I'm trying to speak to is that this is an efficient way to deliver services here. As counsel across the aisle pointed out, the inpatient area of a critical access hospital has a fluctuating census of patients. So it makes sense. This is precisely the kind of hospital that is best serviced by on-call specialist physicians. When there's surgery that needs inpatient surgery that's scheduled, then those surgeons can be brought in from the on-call coverage. That's precisely what type of hospital needs a rural hospital like this needs on-call coverage. But I want to return to but to Your Honor's point, these stipulations here are factual. It says the provider must incur the cost at issue to compensate area physicians for being on call rather than physically present in the hospital. It needs to meet the needs of hospital patients who are admitted into the inpatient area of the hospital. And by the conditions of participation, the physicians must be present to service inpatients in the inpatient areas of the hospital. But I want to return to the point about whether the board here analyzed whether these costs were necessary and proper. The board did not do so. It did not analyze as Congress intended and Congress requires to be done, whether these costs are necessary and proper under the relevant statute and the relevant regulation, which is 413.9. Instead, the board applied a facially inapplicable regulation. The district court affirmed the PRB's decision on this point that 413.70B4, which applies only to on-call costs in emergency department, applied by negative implication. And thus, the board here, when it says that that even with regardless of what state law says, it would fail because of what it's saying is 413.70B4, which is incorrect, as we have explained in our papers.
Suppose the regulation had been explicit rather than the government's argument, a negative implication, a race, the Latin phrase. I was going to say res ipsa loquitur, it's the wrong Latin phrase. Suppose the regulation had been explicit that on call for inpatient is disallowed. What would your view be?
Your Honor, if that had been done through notice and comment rulemaking, as is required under the statute, the Medicare Act of 1395-HHA2, then we might have to concede that these costs are not allowable, but that was not done so here. This was not issued by notice and comment rulemaking. This regulation does not speak to
the regulation was issued by notice and comment, wasn't it?
It doesn't speak to the, it has nothing to do with inpatient costs, Your Honor.
That's your argument. But you concede that if it had been explicit, you'd be out of court.
That if a regulation explicitly prohibited the costs of inpatient on-call costs, would we be precluded from making this argument? Is that your question?
You already answered.
Precluded from being paid? Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor, if done through notice and comment rulemaking.
All right, counsel. We thank you, counsel, for your arguments in this case. Take the matter under submission.